this word incorporated, isn't it?
Cooperation.
Oh, cooperation. The word cooperation, Indian. Dadiyanwankon is the word cooperation. And Dadiyanwankon is a word, it means everybody is pulling together. And I think Ted wanted to come, but somehow he couldn't make it. So I got Bob Haynes here, and I put this word in there, if you want to use that. But I wanted to talk with Ted. Maybe there'd be some other words, some other names that he would pick out and for a little bit shorter. But this here, we can say, Dadiyanwankon.
Well, now, is there something that means almost the same as cooperation?
That's the trouble. That's the trouble.
Yes.
We can't shorten. If you do, why, you wouldn't understand.
You'll lose the meaning.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's what I want to talk to Ted about.
Yes.
And there's other things that I want to talk to him. But maybe someday he'll be up here.
Yes, he'll come when he can. Yeah. He'll probably be here up for Peter Doctor if he can make it.
Yes.
He hopes to come.
So, but, Ted, I'll be looking for you.
Okay. Thanks, Harry.
Annual meeting of the Indian Rights Association, May 14, 1974.
For the business, we have the pleasure of a couple of introductions. A lot of people here know Mr. Lawrence Kennedy, who was General Secretary of our association for many years. And whatever good reputation we enjoy would part his work. And I'd like Mr. Lindley, where is Mr. Lindley? He's sitting modestly over there. Would you stand up a moment? And we have also two leaders of Indian organizations in the neighborhood, and I'm very glad that they're here. Mr. Charles Juancito, who's the head of the Native American Cultural Center of the Delaware Valley. Where is he?
Yeah.
Oh, you were up there. You moved, lost me up. And Mr. William Lynch, who's the president of the United Indians of the Delaware Valley, was also here.
Are
you going to tell us about
we have a non-Indian powwow. We'll be in Salerton, Pennsylvania. We'll be June. Event will be from 12 to 8 p.m. I brought a couple of pictures. And you can pass them around. I think there's one out front there. We'll be starting May 31st. The camping facilities for all those who would like to camp. And we're going to start doing some dancing and drumming at 6 p.m. Friday night. Although all of the people won't be there, but they'll be coming in all night May 31st. June 1 and 2 will start at 12 till 8 p.m. both Saturday and Sunday. And donation is $1.50 for adults and 75 cents for children. Now, I haven't been up there. I don't know that much about the area myself, but I understand it's on Route 113. It's a big park there. And this event will be held rain or shine. So the weather's not going to be a factor for us, and I hope to see a lot of you at this event. And And I also like to thank Mr. Cadwater and the Indian Rights Association for inviting me and my organization to their 92nd anniversary. Thank you.
We also have with us down from Penn State, Mr. Harvey Jacobs, who represents the organization that I always have trouble pronouncing. Tell me again, Mr. Bonacido.
Panacanea.
Would you stand up, Mr. Jacobs?
I am.
Tell us what it stands for, Pennsylvania Coalition.
Well, I can't claim being a representative of this whole I think the other people are representatives of Panacanea. I just know of it. I'm a grad student. I'm from Canicksburg, Pennsylvania, and I'm an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokees.
Well, we're glad to have you and all another Indians here. I'd like to introduce everybody, but we wouldn't get our speaker back to Washington to do that. So we will proceed to the brief business meeting, and the first order of business is the reading of the minutes of the annual meeting of a year ago.
Chairman, I move the reading of the minutes be dispensed with, please.
Is there a second to this motion?
A second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are here, and if anybody can't go home without reading them, they're available on the table right here. The second order of business is the financial report for the past year. Mr. Lindley, you're going to give us the report on behalf of the treasurer who isn't here.
I don't like to have my back to people, so I'll stand up here. Well, I don't have the blessing of being a financial expert, so maybe I can put the annual report in terms that at least to me make sense and maybe will to others. The Indian Rights started out the year 1973 with $2,261 in the bank. The total receipts for the year were $19,157, and the total disbursements were $25,892, for a deficit of $6,735, which was made up by borrowing from one of the Philadelphia banks to a total of $5,500. This left at the end of the year $2,261 in the cash account. Fortunately, the organization does have endowment and other investments, and these have a total book value of approximately $24,000, but a market value of $65,000, so that the bank loan is more than covered by these assets. The books for the year 1973, for the year calendar year 1973, have been audited by Stockton, Bates & Company, and I have here a letter from them certifying that they are in good order.
Thank you, Mr. Lindley. Is there a motion that this report be accepted? Hope there is.
I so moved.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
It's accepted, and if anybody wants to look at it, here's another copy. The third order of business is the election of directors for the coming year. Dr. Blaine, representing the nominating committee, will I give his nomination?
Mr. President, and representing the nominating committee, Mr. Chairman, is Jonathan M. Steer, Jr., unfortunately sick at home, unable to come tonight. He makes the following nomination. For the board of directors for the coming year, Lawrence E. Lindley, Secretary Emeritus, Leo T. Conner, Esquire, Director Emeritus, Theodore B. Hetzel, Jonathan M. Steer, Jr., Charles E. Pancoast III, Thomas Wistar, Jr., John S. E. Esquire, John Cadwallader, Mrs. Jean Hanson Fisher, Dr. Daniel Blaine, L. Eldon Lindley, Jr., Robert L. Haynes, D. Morris Davis IV, Mrs. Betty Neely, Mrs. F. G. Buff, John R. Diamond, James J. Binns Esquire, Mrs. John Dilks, J. Philip Buskirk.
Thank you, Dr. Blaine. Is there a second to these nominations?
I second this nomination.
Move the nomination to be closed.
I so moved.
Second to that? All those in favor?
Aye.
No. The railroad through and we start. The only other thing you have to submit to as part of the business meeting is a few remarks by the President, which I'll make brief. Begin by welcoming members and friends to the 92nd annual meeting of the Indian Rights Association. Most of you know that our association was founded nearly a century ago by a group of Philadelphians concerned about the deteriorating lot of our country's first inhabitants, particularly the Sioux, whose heroic resistance to white encroachments was leading up to the tragedy of Wounded Knee. I would remind you of the goals of our association as defined in our charter. Since lack of clarity as to our purpose has led sometimes to criticism of our effectiveness, we were established to protect the legal rights of Indians, and particularly the political and civil rights guaranteed to them by treaty and statute, but frequently denied them just the same, then as they are now. And this we attempt to do through talks and lectures by board members, particularly Dr. Hetzel and Mr. Haynes, and through our publication, Indian Truth, which is on the table tonight, which I hope you picked up. It's the most recent edition. And through replies sent out from our office to a very large number of requests for information, which come from schools, libraries, and individuals, and increasingly, unfortunately, from the press and from other media. We have in the neighborhood of 6,000 mailings out of the office a year, many of which are printed material, which we have in stock, but a great many of them require personal answers. I thought you might be interested and perhaps amused by an example of the kind of letter which Mrs. Fricken in our office keeps herself very busy answering. This was from a schoolgirl in Guatemala, and she writes, "Dear Sirs, I was wondering if you could send me as much information as possible on the subject of Indian rights. The reason for this is because I have a U.S. history teacher who makes all kinds of crazy statements on the subject of the Indians, and I feel he has no background information to support his statements. I would appreciate anything you could send me. Thank you." Well, this is a little girl in Guatemala, and we get this kind of thing from most of the countries of Western Europe, from Mexico, from the Canal Zone, many other parts of the world. And answering such things, I hope that we're doing our part for the cause. These efforts and the salaries of our two full-time and one part-time staff members use up just about all of our annual budget, which, as you heard from Mr. Lindley, would not be great. It has been stated with some truth that none of this is of direct benefit to Indians, and some think that we should use our income and even our capital to help meet Indian needs for medical, legal, educational, and every other kind of help. In the first place, our limited funds would provide less than a drop in the bucket of Indian needs. But the main argument against this criticism is that we believe that our purpose, as defined in our charter, is best served by educating the white community and trying to create a climate of sympathy for the Indians' cause and understanding of their problems. In the early days, our association acted as a pro-Indian lobby with a full-time representative in Washington for this purpose. We can no longer do this, but we have, to the best of our ability, broadcast the Indian position on matters involving government action. We do not presume to speak as Indians. Only an Indian can do that. And we try to avoid involvement in cases where Indians themselves disagree. But in major matters of government policy towards Indians, where there is a clear distinction between right and wrong, we have taken strong stands. We opposed the termination policy from the beginning and fought for its repeal. We worked for the return of the Taos Blue Lake to its rightful owners. We supported the Passamaquoddies in their legal battle, still continuing to recover land taken from them by the state of Maine. We have and continue to draw attention to threats to the Havasupai grazing rights, to the violation of Indian fishing rights in the state of Washington, and to a host of similar cases falling directly within the terms of our charter. While doing this, our ears have not been completely deaf to more direct needs for immediate tangible help. In the past year, we made cash contributions to the Onondaga Nation to help with the defense of the steelworkers in Philadelphia, to the Indian Historical Society after the disaster to their warehouse, to the scholarship fund in memory of our former board member, Dr. Spruce, to the Indian Legal Defense Service, the United Southeastern Tribes, and several other especially worthy Indian causes. We also tried, with some success, to bring together specific Indian needs and foundations in a position to meet them. That is, when we know of some tribe or group that needs money, we know of a foundation whose charter permits them to provide that money. A couple of letters brings them together, and occasionally the need is met. While these efforts continue, we are happily aware what seems to be the most significant development in the long history of Indian-white relations, the new effectiveness of Indians themselves in defending their rights. Passive submission to white dominance, such as was the pattern in the years after the end of armed resistance, no longer prevails. And I am not here referring to the use of force at the BIA in Wounded Knee, but to the vocal and outspoken expression of the Indian point of view in such publications as Akwesasne Notes and in the speeches and writings of a growing number of educated, intelligent, and articulate Indian leaders. These men and women, working within the white man's system and with a remarkable mastery of his legal and political techniques, are making Indian rights and the all too frequent violation of them known as never before. We of the Indian Rights Association are proud to think that we and they are moving forward together towards the same goal. And now we come to the important part of the evening and the reason why most of you are here. I referred a minute ago to the group of vigorous and effective Indian leaders who are doing such a splendid job of bringing awareness of Indian aspirations to the rest of the country. Among these is to be numbered Richard LaCourse, head of the American Indian Press Association, a Washington clearinghouse for information about Indians and Indian affairs to the community at large, but especially to other Indians, thus knitting together the otherwise isolated efforts of many scattered groups and tribes with similar problems. I don't like long introductions, as Mr. LaCourse can speak for himself better than I can for him, but we are delighted that he is here with us, and I present him to you without further delay, Mr. Richard LaCourse.
In which Indian communities and Indian tribes have selected people historically and select people today to represent the social and political interests and, of course, the religious interests of Indian people. My work is the work of a journalist. I'm in some senses a professional. I am an American Indian from the Pacific Northwest, an enrolled member of the tribe. And the remarks I have to make this evening are remarks which come through the very intense, saturated experience of working as an Indian journalist across the whole of the 50 states and across the country to the north, the Canadian nations within the country of Canada. My remarks this evening are directed both to my Indian friends. I see many that I have known here over the last year and the recent months, and many of my new non-Indian friends in the city of Philadelphia. My topic is the unseen American, and I think that it is one that is relevant, interesting, and problematic both for Indian people and non-Indian people in the moving toward the heart of the 1970s. Much of what I have to say tonight, I think, will create in the Indian listener a particular state of Indian blues. We're in pretty damned hard times as a community of people surviving, continuing to survive within the larger society, and I have bracketed my remarks in two areas. First, the increasing negative forces which continue to pressure and weigh upon American Indian people and which jeopardize their continuity as a people. My second body of observations, which come out of my work as a journalist, are addressed to those massive, historic, affirmative forces which are taking larger and larger and larger shape within the national Indian community, which will certainly shape our common history, the Native American history, to the end of this century and into the next. A judge in the city of Albuquerque, New Mexico last year, in recording a decision of major importance for the flooding of two north central New Mexico pueblos, a decision incidentally which went in favor of the pueblos and which ensured that rivers would not flood the heartland of those two pueblos, defined the state of the racial relationships of Indians and non-Indians as one partitioned by a turquoise curtain of misunderstanding. This phrase may be equated with other phrases you've heard, the iron curtain, the cotton curtain, the bamboo curtain, and such. But there is nevertheless evidently a turquoise curtain of misunderstanding which separates the many historic, near-eternal Indian communities in America from the non-Indian. There are continuing bearers of misunderstandings, tragic and deadly misunderstandings. There are continuing racial stereotypes which prohibit us from understanding one another and which aggravate our political, our religious, our social, and our cultural problems with one another. It is this type of thing this evening which I hope to describe from the drone position of a working journalist. I have traveled in my 3 years with the American Indian Press Association nearly a 500,000 miles, repeatedly across the whole of the United States, very often zigzagging north to south to north to south, more often traveling east to west, and infrequently and very pleasurably becoming acquainted with the many Indian nations across Canada, who incidentally proved to me that the border separating the North American tribes and the Canadian tribes is one of artifice and not one of reality. Being a man of some sensibility, I find myself caught up in what the Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard called a repeated sense of the oscillation of mood. Being open to people, I hope, listening carefully, attempting to feel carefully, attempting to comprehend the quiet, uttered concerns of the many Indian people in the country, I find my own life brought very high and crashing down in a constant repetition of the many moods of Indian people themselves. And this forces me to define the American Indian man, the American Indian woman, of many ages, I should say of all ages, from babyhood to the very old, the oldest of the ages that we live, finding ourselves as Indian people, really people in a sense of two faces, or of two responses, or of two positions, a face facing north and a face facing south. I think that Indian people, by and large today, at least across the northern United States that I have seen, and the Canadian, the many Canadian provinces and territories, are very much alike in that we are these. We are a creature under an unparalleled state of siege, equivalent to the state of siege we experienced in the so-called periods of the Indian Wars. Today, our state of siege is a little subtler, but nonetheless deadly version of racial confrontation, of political confrontation, and of continuing erosion and loss. On the other side of the Indian character and on the other side of the Indian experience is that Indian that I know, that I have cherished, that I have had the privilege to be brought up with, and now I have the privilege of seeing the national experience of this Indian man and this Indian woman who, unlike most of the other people I see in America, is that man and that woman being a creature of the unparalleled capacity for ecstasy. A totally unanticipatable kind of American today. We know, by and large, what our society is comprised of in the month of May in 1974. We all, of course, have the Watergate blues, I think. We are approaching a bicentennial. We are a nation which is nearing 200 years. Perhaps we are a spent society. Perhaps we are a people who have to completely reorient ourselves, and I'm speaking as a citizen of the United States. When I look into the largely unexamined universe of Indian people today, I find a different knowledge of the universe, a different knowledge of what the cosmos is, a different sacred relationship to existence, which provides the Indian man and the Indian woman today a capacity for ecstasy, for total joy, for total inner knowledge, that the average American is absolutely and perhaps irrevocably deprived of. It is this inner sense, it is this inner core, the inner retention of a truth which has survived for decades and decades and for centuries and centuries within the Indian people of America, which makes the Indian people Indian today and which ensures there will be an Indian future. However, and I want to begin now detailing many of the manifestations of the negative forces which I think force the Indian to feel, either the Indian man or the Indian woman, to feel that he or she is experiencing in the 1970s, in our enlightened day and age, in which we are largely educated, largely politically aware, largely culturally aware and socially aware, yet today experiencing a very deadly and sophisticated state of siege. The first and I think most important manifestation of this state of siege, which is peculiar to the mentalities of most minorities, is that there is today, in a documentable journalistic fashion, a subtler and infinitely more complex aggressive war over the lands, waters, timbers, and natural resources of the American Indian, particularly in the West. I think that Watergate and what it means, without taking either a pro or con side toward this recent rather dark revelation in Washington, shows the public at large the kind of machination that is possible between the large corporate interests of America and the various political parties which win elections and hold terms of either 4 or 8 years. Many Indians I've had the opportunity to talk to of both sexes across the country feel that the lesson of Watergate is one which Indians have been subject to for decades and decades and decades. In political terms, this comes down to the fact that the White House, under both administrations, is willing to belly up and buddy up to those natural resource development interests, such as oil, coal, uranium, timber clear-cutting and the like, and the one who loses is inevitably and irrevocably the American Indian and the American Indian tribes. So we do have a very complex state of war, a war waged in the most ethereal kind of political jargon, in the most unexaminable kind of dickering, which constitutes our political process in Washington. Right now, in the Southwest, there still remain 19 historic pueblos. These pueblos have had a religious union which has existed for at least 2,500 years that we know of. If you've had the opportunity of traveling in northern New Mexico, and I was there last week, you can go up to San Ildefonso, San Felipe, in Sandia, across the whole northern part of the state. And what do you find? You find that the real estate interests of the East, most of the real, and I hope I don't offend any too much, I hope I don't offend any of you in the audience if you're top realty people in the Eastern Seaboard. And then again, I hope I do offend you if you're doing this. You find these 19 historic pueblos have a train of rivers and occasional lakes dotting the northern part of the state. What has happened through the complicity of the governorship, the governor's house in the state of New Mexico, a number of corporate interests, is that there are now large so-called miracle cities being built amid the pueblos. If you have visited the very arid southwest area, you know that the most precious commodity in the southwest is the commodity of water. There are historic Supreme Court legal rights to water which extend to all Indians countrywide and are probably more paramount interest to Indians in the southwest because of the heavily arid nature of the terrain in that area. In any case, through the complicity of the state houses, many corporations, the consent of the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, we now face, in the period of the next 10 or 15 years, the ultimate removal and transfer of several of the Pueblo people out of that area because of the influx of white populations into these new overnight desert towns, certainly not built for Indians. These societies have been in place in those precise, exact places for nearly 3 millennia. and it takes the political dickering of your society and my society, your government and my government, your political parties and mine, to ensure that the Pueblo people may soon face death as a people. This is what I mean by the subtle and infinitely complex continuing state of warfare which many Indian people experience today.